So this morning's lesson was focused on the passage in Mark 4, verse 35 through 41, the discussion about Jesus and the disciples going on the Sea of Galilee, a body of water where there was the possibility very often for just sudden intense storms to come about and bring about destruction, to sink boats, to bring men and women to a watery doom. And so you have in that passage that nearly happening. That storm comes about and the disciples are on there, and we discuss these ideas about what would happen if, instead of Jesus being on the boat at the time, what if there was different items? What if there was a pile of money or a business card or a spouse there? And basically we illustrated what would happen if a storm arises and we're not in a boat where Jesus is. Ultimately, it doesn't end well. But today, I want us to pick up on this same story, the same illustration, but exactly how it plays out. Just as the story goes, where we go and find Jesus on the back of this boat, he wakes up, he's able to cry out, "Peace be still," and he's able to calm the storm. And in that, there's several questions that are asked in the passage. The disciples, initially, they come and ask Jesus, "Carest thou not that we perish?" Jesus himself says, "Why are you fearful? Why are you not faithful?" Jesus goes and he calms the storm, and afterwards the disciples ask, "What manner of man is this, that even the winds and the seas obey him?" I want to focus or structure this lesson then based on the questions that are asked and the questions that could have been asked in this situation, in this story from Mark 4, 35 through 41. I want to consider, not just what is actually asked in the text, but if we were there ourselves, some questions that might go through our minds in considering and seeing what Jesus did and how these events played out. Let's go one that is most immediately asked in the text. Here's the first question. "Carest thou not that we perish?" Going to the back of the boat and you find Jesus sleeping, and you want to know, "Jesus, do you even care that the boat is flooding? That the winds are increasing? Do you even care that we're about to die? Does that matter to you at all? You're back here sleeping like nothing is happening, like it's no big deal. Jesus, do you even care? Does it even matter to you?" Aside from where I'm working, I'm also going to school, doing some online education for professional counseling. And so I'm trying to do a master's program in that. And one of the things that is regularly taught or regularly emphasized in a counseling setting is you have to show empathy. You have to show that you care about the client. It's not just enough to try to have the right answers and try to say the right things. You have to show that they matter and that you understand what they are experiencing, what they are feeling in that session. When I was at Heritage last year, I remember taking a class on counseling, and we sort of had to do a practice session. And so we'd pair up, the students would pair up in the class. One person would be the client with this pretend problem. The other person would be the counselor. We'd try to help them, and we recorded it. And so we recorded these sessions, and the teacher watched them and gave us feedback. She came back the next day, and she said, "Well, yeah, I think you all did pretty good. But there was something I noticed that was a challenge with the guys." And she said the problem with what the guys were doing was we would ask questions, we were trying to collect the information, and we were trying to assess the problem, but not once did we ask, "How do you feel about this? How is this affecting you emotionally? What are you experiencing? That must be difficult. That must be challenging. That must be very frustrating for you. That must be disheartening." Never made any kind of empathetic statements, and I think that's pretty typical and challenging for men in general. I've only been married 5 years, but that's long enough for me to learn that in a disagreement with my wife, even on the rare occasion where I'm 100% right and she is 100% wrong, it doesn't happen very often. But even in that situation, even if I'm 100% right, if I don't acknowledge how she feels, and if I don't acknowledge her perspective, if I don't acknowledge how the subject at hand is affecting her, it doesn't matter how logical my thought process is. If I just show no empathy, I'm not going to win. I'm not going to win that argument. The same thing goes with counseling. People are not just cars that you work on and you assess the problem and then you fix it. you have to show some emotional support, some emotional care. I think in general that applies to both men and women with how we interact with one another, but I think we also want that sense with God as well. We want to know, God, do you care about what I'm going through? God, do you care about this storm that has arisen, these rains and these flooding waters and these winds that are ravaging my life? God, does it even matter to you when I come and present that challenge to you in my prayer life? Do you even care? So then for that question, I want to consider at least one answer. You can probably answer it in different ways. I think at least one answer to consider is in 1 Peter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5, if you would turn there. In the context here is the opening of this chapter is Peter encouraging elders in the church, men in the church who have authority over the congregation, over the flock, and he basically tells them, don't lord over the flock. Don't just be authority figures. Don't just press people under your thumb. You need to have a compassionate relationship with them. You need to care for them. You need to tend to their needs. You need to be a servant to them. In some sense, he says you need to show empathy. You need to actually care about the people who are under your authority. And to show an illustration of what that looks like, he gives the greatest example of compassion and care from an authority figure in the form of God. 1 Peter 5, verse 6, he says, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him. Verse number 7. And read that there, why he says to cast all your care upon him. Cast all your care upon God because it's a command to pray and that we ought to pray because we need to do that because God has commanded us. Now what he says. Cast all your care upon God because praying is part of the Christian life and we need to pray to be holy and to fulfill his righteousness. That's not what he says. Cast all of that care upon God. Why? Because he cares for you. Because it matters to him. God says, come and bring your burdens and your weightier matters in life and talk to me about all these storms. It matters to me. Not simply because he has the potential to fix it, to heal you, to help you, but because he actually and genuinely cares about what you are experiencing, what you are going through. We don't serve a God that is so high and holy and powerful in his authority that he looks down on the insignificant human and says, you don't matter. That's not the God we serve. We don't serve a God who lacks empathy. We don't serve a God who says, you are unimportant to me. In fact, God said, you are so important, I will take on flesh and learn experientially what it's like to be a human. I will go through that as a person, suffering all manner of temptation, dying on the cross. In fact, Jesus got so much of the full-fledged human experience, he's probably had experienced more temptation than most of us will ever have in our own lives. Tempted in all points that we are, yet without sin. Can God know how I feel when those storms arrive? Yes, because he's been there. Does God care how I feel? Does God care what I'm going through? Does he care about the storms that are shaking the boat that I'm in, that make me so fearful that my life is at stake? Yes, because he says, cast all your cares upon him because he cares for you. You're in that boat and the storm comes and you ask Jesus, carest thou not that we perish? But even, here's a second question you might ask that probably would even come before our initial one. Before we ask Jesus, do you care? We might ask Jesus, were you even listening? Before we went and found him on the back of the boat, we are crying out, Jesus, where are you? Jesus, why are you not helping us scoop water off the deck? Jesus, why are you not out here helping to keep the boat from capsizing? Jesus, are you even listening and paying attention to what I'm saying? It's a very, reasonable insecurity to wonder, is God listening to what I am saying? Does God listen or hear me when I'm crying out to him and I'm trying to ask him for help? One possibility is to say that God might not be listening. You see in Isaiah 59, 1 and 2, where God says, sin can separate you so far from him, a ravenous, sinful life can pull you so far away from him that when that storm comes, he's not going to listen. Because you have separated yourself. Your sins have separated you from God. But I don't know that for a lot of us in here, it's that we're living so wickedly that God is far away. Yet we still might have that lingering feeling, that sense of doubt. God, are you even paying attention to what I'm trying to tell you, for the help that I'm trying to ask for you? It's the nature of, I would say, a blind faith. Oftentimes, critics in Christianity will say a blind faith is believing something without evidence, which that's not what a blind faith means in the Bible. A blind faith is believing in something you have evidence for, but you don't see what that evidence points you towards. Just as an example, we believe in a God and we believe there's evidence for a God. We believe the creation around testifies of a creator. We see that evidence. We don't see the God that it points to, though. Just as Abraham, who was called to believe God would give him and Sarah a child, even though they were so old, even perhaps at times when they had never seen two people at that age that they were have children before. Abraham was called to believe that. He'd never seen it before. But what had he seen? He'd seen God rescue him over and over again from Egypt. He'd seen God provide for him in the land of Canaan. He'd seen God, or he knew about God, as far as we know, rescuing Lot, or he pleaded with God for rescuing Lot several times. I mean, he had seen God working in his life enough to know that he should trust God when he says to trust in something that even you don't see. We as Christians are called to trust that our prayers rise up to heaven and are heard by our Lord. And that's difficult. When we're sitting across from another human being, we want to know that they're paying attention to us. And you think about what we look at to check that. We check if they're awake. We check their nonverbals. We check their facial expression. We check how their body's moving. We look at all that those physical signs that tell us that they are paying attention and that they are hearing us. We don't see God, though. We don't see his nonverbals. We don't see his facial expression. We don't see him in a one-on-one conversation interacting with us. So it's a challenge sometimes, and maybe we wonder, God, were you even listening? Are you even listening? One, I wouldn't say there's a complete cure for that, but one thing I would encourage us to do, if we're ever having that doubt, ever having that insecurity, I would encourage us to look back on past times in our life when God has heard our prayer. And even when we say God has answered our prayer in a positive way, God has answered our cries for help in a way that we can see his providence. We can see him working in our past lives. Just when we moved back from Texas back in July, or we moved back to Texas, rather, this past July, it was a little bit challenging, I'll be honest with you. Financially, it was a little bit difficult because it took me a while to find a job. I didn't find a full-time ministry while I was in Alabama as far as a work in that arena. And even when we came back here, I was struggling to find some type of secular work. And it took me probably about 3 months before I actually got a good job interview. And it was straining us quite a bit financially for that period of time. I went into this interview with the place I'd eventually end up working, this private boarding school. And the interview went really well. And they basically told me, you're probably going to get the job. You still have to do a second interview and a lot of formalities, but you're probably going to get this job. I was excited. I was happy in that interview. It was a weight off my shoulders for a little while. But the one question they asked me was, do you have a reliable vehicle? I said, yes. Now, we only have the one truck right now. This is the truck we have outside that we drove up here in, but it's a 2001 Dodge Dakota. It was in good shape. And so I said, yes, we have a reliable vehicle. So Megan comes and picks me up from the interview. We're driving about 5 minutes, and I start seeing smoke billowing from under the hood. And, you know, the cold hot meter on the dashboard, it was touching the letter. I mean, it was getting on the H. It was past the little red marker. It was the smoke was coming out. And we started panicking because this had never happened before. This truck had never overheated before. So we were struggling, but we were able to get it off the road and get the truck to the McCarty Student Center. It's a campus ministry in San Marcos. And fortunately, there were some elders there who were vehicle savvy, and they kind of knew how to diagnose that kind of stuff. They looked under our hood, and they checked that found out our radiator, which keeps the truck cool, was leaking water. And so much so that it was practically bone dry of water and coolant, and so the truck was overheating because of that. And basically said, you'll need a new radiator. So I waited a few hours. This is all in one day. Same day as this interview, by the way. Waited a few hours, let the engine cool. They told me, put more water in it, put more coolant in it. Then you should be able to get home and at least get the truck to your house. I said, okay. So I did that, and we drove. We almost made it to the house, but we got stuck again because the truck started overheating again, and so we got stuck in an HEB parking lot just down the road from where we lived. And it was actually very scary because the truck was so dry of water that the engine was vibrating and shaking the whole truck. It felt like the truck was going to explode. Like, that's the only way I could describe it. It really scared me, actually. So I said, I'm going to leave it here. And I'll let the engine cool again. I'll come back later, and I'll fill it up and take care of it. So still, this is all still the same day. I'll tell you at this point, I was panicking quite a bit because, like I said, we were strained a lot financially. We had one vehicle. I just got out of an interview that looked like I was going to get the job, and now I was afraid if they asked me to come working next week, I'm going to have to say I can't get there because my vehicle is not starting. I didn't know anything about repairing radiators or how much they cost or how, you know, long it takes to fix it. And I was asking myself, can I afford to do this? How long is it going to take? How is Megan going to get to work? I don't have any money for this. It got to a point where I was literally on my knees in prayer and talking to God and saying, look, I don't come to God and ask a lot for financial blessings, but I said, I don't know what to do. I am scared. I am nervous. And all these feelings, all this anxiety and worry and fear was just building up to the point that my stomach was hurting, my head was hurting, and physically I just felt awful. And so I was definitely praying to God, and I went back a few hours later to check on my truck, and found the icing on the cake, which is not good. I went to the truck in the parking lot, and I walk up to it, and I find this on the rear driver's side door, this very large dent that was not there 2 hours ago, that is still there if you want to look after services and go see it. This very large dent in this door, and I just put my hands on my head, and I'm thinking, somebody just hit and run my truck in a parking lot. I wasn't even there for it. And there wasn't even a lot of cars around, so I didn't understand what had just happened. And so of all that fear and anxiety and worry building up, now I've got a little bit of rage starting to spark. And it got me to my boiling over point. We talked about in Bible class this morning where I said it takes a lot for me to get angry, aggressive, as far as my personality goes. I don't struggle using foul language or cussing or anything like that. That's not a temptation for me personally. I was just about ready to say every bad word that I ever knew. Or maybe make up a few new ones just because of how upset I was. And I was ready to boil over. And I walked around the truck checking to see if there's any other damage. I found this little slip of paper in the windshield wipers. I picked it up, and it was a police report. Now, this person did not do a hit and run. They actually filed a police report and left their insurance information. They took responsibility for it. I didn't get the door fixed, you know, the door still works and the window still works and everything. It's just a big dent there. I actually got a settlement check for over $1,000 from that. I was able to pay the bills. I was able to get the truck fixed. I was even keeping food on the table with that until I started getting paid for it. And maybe it was a coincidence, but it's hard looking back sometimes on incidents like that and thinking that God was not involved, that God was not helping, that God was not aiding. And I think maybe for a lot of us as Christians, when we've gone to God before too and asked for help, It's not always that God has said no. It's not always that God has said not now. Sometimes God does say yes. Like sometimes God does bless us and help us and aid us. And I'm not just talking about physical or financial. God certainly blessed me in many more ways than that. But I think it's best for us to, if we ever question, God, are you listening? Think back on those times. Think back on those examples where God has blessed you. God has worked in your life. He has answered prayers. Because if we are truly his people and we're truly listening, I think we will have examples. We'll have times where God has worked in our lives through our prayers. Sometimes we ask the question, God, carest thou not that we perish? Even if we're on that boat, we might say, Jesus, were you even listening? But even one more question we might ask, after we see him come out of that sleep and he calms the sea, says, peace, be still. Maybe instead of saying, what manner of man this is, how amazing Jesus is, we might have a negative reaction and say, why didn't you do that before the storm came about? Instead of saying, waiting until the storm scared us and terrified us and made us think we're going to die, why didn't you prevent the storm in the first place? God, why didn't you stop the disaster before it happened? Maybe a more general way we might rephrase it is, God, why do you allow bad things to happen in the first place? Why do you allow these storms to arise, these disasters to occur? I guarantee that as much as on the news there's so much debate about gun laws with this past shooting, tragic shooting in the Florida school, there's also a debate being had about where's God in all this? Why did God not intervene? Why did God not stop that individual, that tragedy from occurring, from people, innocent people dying? It's a very natural question for us to ask, and we wonder if God is so powerful and so mighty and can simply speak the storms and the seas into quietness, why doesn't he stop all bad things from happening? Well, there's at least a few reasons why disasters happen in the very first place. One reason would be the nature of free will. That God made man as free will human beings, thus he gives us a choice to do right and a choice to do wrong. We have the choice to love our neighbors and to do good to other people. We also have the choice to do incredible evil, incredible harm, sometimes verbally, sometimes physically. But God has made man with the ability to choose his own path, whether it's right or wrong. And maybe we say, well, God should stop people whenever they're trying to sin. God should stop people and intervene and strike people down whenever they're trying to do something evil. We say that, I worry how many of us would be here tonight if God was doing that every time somebody sinned. I wonder who would be here. I don't think I would be if God was trying to intervene and strike me down every time I did something wrong or immoral or wicked. I don't know that I would ask that of God, even though events like what happened this past week are awful. We need to at least understand the factor, the element, that God does allow us to make really good or really bad choices. But an even more significant reason why disasters happen, terrible things happen in this world, I would say even more broadly than just our individual free will, is a result of Adam and Eve's sin. Because sometimes we ask, you know, why didn't you just make a world where bad things don't happen, where nobody gets sick, nobody dies, nobody gets disease or cancer or feels physical pain or goes through all this tragedy? And my first response is, God did make a world like that. Go back and read the beginning of the Bible. Go back and read Genesis 1 and 2. That's exactly the world God made. Well, why isn't it like that today? Well, read Genesis 3. Adam and Eve made a choice. A choice that we are not guilty of. I'm not condoning original sin. I'm not saying that we're guilty of Adam and Eve's sin, but I am pointing out the fact that their sin has affected the world that we live in. As far as we know, before they made that choice to rebel against God, to eat that fruit, they weren't subject to disease, they weren't subject to illness, they weren't subject to worry about tsunamis and tornadoes and natural disasters coming in and causing so much pain and illness and worry in their lives. They were in the garden, they were protected by God. The world we live in today is the post-sin world. It's the world that has been touched by the stain of iniquity. When we see tragedies happen and we see birth defects and we see people getting terminal illnesses and we see natural disasters, it shouldn't make us say, look how terrible God is. It should make us say, look how terrible sin is. Look what it has done to this world. And again, I'm not saying that a person gets cancer because they are sinful. But I am saying that these types of natural tragedies happen because sin originally entered the world in Genesis 3. In the same way that, just as a sort of an example, a mother who is pregnant with a child, she chooses to abuse some substance, to use drugs. Guess what? It's going to affect the development of that child. That child will be born into a world where possibly it is born addicted to some illegal substance. It is born with certain birth defects, and that child has done nothing good or nothing bad. But the choices of that child's mother has consequences that affects the baby. In the same way, Adam and Eve made a choice that affected the entire rest of the world. And so we deal with the consequences of that. We'd ask the question, you know, carest thou not that you perish? Were you even listening? Why didn't you just prevent the disaster in the first place? But all of these are sort of skeptical questions, but at the end of it, at the end of the story, they ask the right question. What manner of man is this that even the winds and the seas obey him? That even nature itself bows down in submission to this one and only Lord Jesus Christ? That's the realization we ought to come to then. That's the question we ought to ask, is look how amazing and powerful our Lord truly is. Consequently, then, I think even when we ask questions God might be asking us some questions as well. Just as Job, throughout the book, as he's struggling with his tragedies, he's saying, God, why aren't you doing this, or why are you judging me unfairly? He's very skeptical about why God is not intervening with all his troubles and tribulations. At the end of the book, God says, well, let me ask you a question, and you answer me. Tonight, it may be God's asking us, do you care enough to have faith that I listen when you pray? Do you care enough to not blame every tragedy in life on me? Or to say that I'm the one causing it, or that I'm the one overwhelming your life with storms? Do you care enough to trust in God's love for you? To believe that he cares when you bring your burdens and your worries to him? I think God may, for some of us, be asking, carest thou not that ye perish? Not being in the Lord's church, carest thou not that you perish? Not being baptized for the remission of your sins, carest thou not that you perish? Living your life for your spouse or for money or for your career, for anyone or anything else except Jesus, carest thou not that you perish? There's at least one person that cares whether or not you're perishing, and that's Jesus. So I ask, do you care about him? And do you care that you're perishing? Do you want to be saved? Do you want to be right with God? Here's your chance. Let's stand and sing Song of Invitation.